point mm-hmm. for everybody. So when you would go through there, you would see, I mean, they had a little, I mean, all that wasn't there. I mean, that was just one Exxon station was sitting there.
Uh-huh.
And that's where all the trucks, everything would come. None of that Marion was there. It was a little town of about 300 people.
Wow.
But it's grown because people left West Memphis to move to Marion because West Memphis was too black, so they moved to Marion and got a better school districts and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. But in the 50s, it was just like the highway there sort of intersected. So it was just a big gas station and everybody would go there. And if we came from Lepanto, wherever we came from, that's where we'd stop, go to the bathroom, get gas, all that other kind of crap. So it was interesting, you know, so that had some significance of that spot. I think the gas station was Hex. Guy's name Ed, and he had a diner and all this. You know, you go back to the 50s, and it was, I remember that was always, you know, last chance to get gas.
So let me just start by saying this is Julie Wise, and I'm interviewing Bernard Lipsey for the Bracero Oral History Project. Today is September 22nd, 2008. Farmers, so anyway, I just wanted to say that before. So let me just start and ask, where and when were you born?
Well, I was actually born in Memphis, but mm-hmm. grew up in Lepanto, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. And when were you born?
October 1945.
Okay. And where were you raised?
In Lepanto. We didn't have a hospital. We didn't have that. You had to come to Memphis to get born, and then you went home after staying in the hospital 2 weeks.
And what was your parents' profession? How did your family make a living?
We had a grocery store.
And what? Tell me about the grocery store. What was that like?
Well, just a little prehistory. My father was from New York, from the Bronx.
Oh, wow.
Was stationed down here during World War II. Met my mother. Went overseas. Got wounded. Came home. Came back here to get my mother to get married. And it was just 20 years. I think she was 21 and he was 22, something like that. Took her to New York. I mean, this guy's uneducated, no money, no anything. You know, they're 20 years old, and they really knew nothing compared to what 20-year-olds today know. She had never been out of this part of the country. She stayed in New York about 6 weeks, and she said, nope, not for me. I'm back here. So he came back. He saw a picture of my grandfather's store. He worked in the store, learned about the grocery business, and then moved to the next town after a year, and opened up in the next town.
Hmm. And so, what year was that?
They probably were there in 47, 48.
Okay. And that was in Lepanto. And right. So previously the grandfather was in Marktree, you said? Okay. And what was life like in Lepanto at that time?
Mayberry on TV. The Andy Griffith Show?
Uh-huh.
Sort of like that. It was just, I mean, you know, you had a... You want to talk on the phone, you rang the phone, you picked up the phone, you said, Miss Hoffman, call my store for me, give my day, you know, whatever it was. It's, you know, we didn't lock any doors. Keys were left in the car. You didn't have to worry about crime. There wasn't any of that stuff going on. Mm-hmm. It was just pretty dull. I mean, there wasn't much to it.
And who lived in Lepanto at that time? Was it white, black, or you said other groups?
You know, it was
groups?
Probably almost all white.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say, because, you know, in that period of time, all schools were segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So we really, how many blacks there actually were, I couldn't tell you, but mm-hmm. there weren't many. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, maybe 20% of the population, 15-20%. But we always had... You know, everybody had a black housekeeper. Everybody had a black guy working in the store for them. Everybody had, you know, it wasn't uncommon to have it. And it wasn't like they weren't there. It's just, we just didn't, it's everything was segregated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we never went to school with them or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a, you know, it was just a different kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty innocent, pretty, not, not, uh, not anything exciting, not anything that was. But on the other hand, you know, we were small. I mean, see, people are like I only had 30 seniors in my class. So, but everybody got a pretty good education. Most of the class went on to go to school. I know we had one guy that went to be a pharmacist. We had one guy that was a colonel in the Army. We had another guy that, you know, some of them, you know, they'd gone on to be, you know, professional. Some of them had gone to be professional. Probably percentage-wise was as good as anywhere else. I mean, you know, we had our crooks, too, and all that other stuff. And, you know, the whole town revolved around, like everything else, sports. You know, and everybody was into Friday night football, Friday night basketball, all that kind of stuff. But it was pretty much, you know, what if. And then the economy of the town was all built as agriculture. Mm-hmm. The whole system was agriculture-based. Mm-hmm. And as long as they had agriculture, people could make it. And it was so seasonal. It, like you said, we carried everybody on credit.
Yeah, tell me about that.
It's very interesting because today, you know, everything's computer, blackberries, all that stuff, everything, you know, instant. Well, you had these little notebooks, little bitty ones, and you would, if you bought your groceries, you'd put Miss Jones, $35 worth of groceries, and they had a metal, you know, flip chart kind of thing, and it had different letters on there. It had the alphabet and a little clipboard on it, and you would just stick her ticket behind there. Well, what would happen is you'd carry everybody through January, February, March. They didn't really get out in the fields till April. So April, everybody would come pay off whatever they.
And how did they earn money in April if they weren't?
Well, because they said to start, they had to start getting the fields ready.
Oh, so they were paid per day, you're saying?
No. Well, again, a lot of them were sharecroppers.
Okay.
You got percentage of the crop.
Oh, right.
You're right. I'm not talking about Mexicans. I'm talking about the locals,
mm-hmm.
the local economy,
okay.
Which was, again, pretty small because there were a lot of, there just weren't a lot of people there to support the local economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really didn't see a lot of stuff that was going on. I think eventually they did put a couple of factories in the 60s, but in the 50s was 100% agriculture.
Hmm.
There wasn't anything else going on. You either did that. So then, like anybody else, everything was tight.
Hmm.
Then in the spring, when they started planting cotton, and again, it was all weather-based. Because if we had floods or bad spring, they didn't get the crop in or anything, you know, you weren't getting new shoes that year. And the other thing that's interesting about the 50s, it was still pretty archaic. I can remember people still had mules and wagons. Not everybody. I mean, most people had gone to tractors, but there were still people that lived mules and wagons. There were still people that didn't have electricity, had kerosene lamps. They had, a matter of fact, we had butane. We didn't even have gas until maybe in the late 50s. I mean, people certainly didn't have any TVs I'm sure they had some radios, TV, nobody had TVs or air conditioners, any of that kind of stuff. We didn't even have air conditioners. And so it was all revolved around the high school sports and coming to town on Saturday.
Hmm.
I mean, if you had a store during the week, you had very few customers. Usually when they went to the field, well, when you got, once they started the crop growing, because the crop had to be chopped, they call it chopping cotton. They had to chop the weeds away from the plants, or the weeds would overdo the plants. So what they had to do is, because there was no chemicals or anything, there wasn't any of that stuff. So once they started chopping cotton, a lot of people, if they were day labor, especially if they're from Memphis or if you're closer to Memphis, they would come in for the day. They would stop at grocery stores and buy their lunch, buy their stuff. Same thing with the Mexicans. Sometimes they would come into town early in the morning and get what they wanted. But basically, they revolved. They were outside. The Mexicans were outside of the normal day-to-day society. they had their own society outside the rest of us.
Hmm.
When they got on these trucks and they got to town, I mean, they told you like Ritter Company or Stuckey or Forest State. They figured out the system, and they would bring them in, and obviously they got paid something to bring them in, and then they would farm them out to either their farmers, to their superintendents on their farms, or the smaller farmers. So what would happen is that they would come into town, and when they would get to town, whether it be whatever time a night they would come in, they would call. We had an arrangement with the people we dealt with. They would call us. My dad would go open up the store Sunday morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 5, whatever it was. And they would come in, and then they would put them in a group of how many of them were going to each farm and how many were going to live in each house. So when they would come in, then they'd come in the store and say, okay, these 5 Mexicans are going here. So we'd give them a basket. They each got $5 a piece to buy groceries. So if we had 5 guys, they could buy $25 worth of groceries. So my mother had gotten to a point where she learned a little Spanish, and we knew what they needed. First thing they'd come in, we'd all give them a sandwich and a drink, because we know they'd been on truck, and sort of our way of trying to get them to keep coming back. So then we'd go down the line, they'd get a pound of coffee, 5 pounds of sugar, 5 pounds of flour, rice, all the staples. And they'd get this, whatever the groceries were, and then the farmer would take them to one of those houses that you saw. There's not many of them left out there. There may be a few that just an old house somewhere out in the field,
mm-hmm.
and give them a kerosene lamp, and that's where they start. And they would, it's harder, man. I'm sure they weren't very old. I mean, I'm sure I don't even know if they were 18. I'm sure they were, but probably 17 to 20, and probably never been away from home, never done anything, and they're just dropped out in the middle of this field in the middle of the night most of the time, because they would leave Texas in the morning, and when they got there, it would probably wind up being night, and they would just drop them out there. And then next morning, they were up chopping cotton or picking cotton. Usually, they start out chopping cotton. And then as they... probably as they got, after a week of being out in this farm doing all this stuff, they certainly want to see civil. Well, they had to come to town on Saturday. They got paid, and they would come to town. When they got to town, they would usually go to a beer joint. Usually, go, well, what they did first, they're pretty smart. First thing they did is buy their groceries, because they didn't want to. What we did is we delivered. So if you bought your groceries, you'd come in, we'd buy your groceries, we'd put it in, like a bellhop. We'd put it on the side, put your name on it, and then tell them they had to be back at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever time we said, and then we would load them all up in a truck, all their groceries, and take them out. Then it seemed like it was the end of the earth, but it probably wasn't but 5 miles or 3 miles or something. As a kid, you seemed like you were going forever, but it was probably wasn't very far.
So you used to go on these trucks sometimes to take them out there.
Yeah, well, when I got older, mm-hmm. I'd drive sometimes when I got to be 16. But mm-hmm. but as a kid, I remember, because, we had different guys working for us, and I remember, so-and-so's, this truck's leaving at 8 and this one's going to leave at 9. And then after they did that, they'd spend their time. They'd go to movies. They'd hang on the street, because the whole they might be out on one side of town, and they wouldn't know their buddies or cousins or friends were on the other side of town. They didn't have any way to communicate. No phones, no radios. There's no transportation. So the only way they could transport is when they came to town, they would sort of congregate. And you'd have this little town that maybe the whole street was 100 yards long, and the whole town was 1,500 people, and there'd be 500 or 600 Mexicans walking up and down the street. And, it's like an answer. They'd walk from one end to the other. And they would see guys and talk and whatever else, and they would get. And so I'm sure that's how they wound up having some kind of social life.
Right.
Is trying to communicate, seeing who's going where, whatever was going on. So they spent... and you know, and I'm sure, like I said, they went to a movie, they went to do all this, you know, I'm sure they went to beer joints, they did whatever else they were going to do. There were a few, and I would assume they were Texas Mexicans, mm-hmm. that were more permanent, that and again, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know what all those girls were doing there. You don't know what's going on. But, you know, there were some people there that I'm sure, not like today, where, you know, there's prostitutes walking up and down the street and, you know, all this, but there were probably some people that were there that were in the business that were doing some of that stuff. It probably, you know, wasn't flaunted like it is today. I mean, you know, but when you look back and you say, you know, I remember that family lived down the street. That's what they must, you know, that's what they were doing. That's what part of their, you know, part of what was going on.
And it wasn't, were they white or black, these prostitutes?
No, Mexicans.
Mexican women?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
As I said, it was probably a Texas family.
Right.
Somebody that come up there, or somebody that may have come at one time, mm-hmm. and saw what it was. And again, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't flaunted, it wasn't conspicuous, or wasn't, you know, a sign outside, but, you know, you knew they were there. And it was kind of thing that I'm sure some of that, I mean, I know, you know, when he reached for it, not to go on, mm-hmm. but I'm sure it was like, you know, it's just, it was quiet. I mean, you know, it just, you know, you live in a small town, all that, whatever went on, look, it's just like there was Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And I lived there for 18 years. And I never, ever, I mean, you see the movie Mississippi Burning? I mean, that was 63.
Yeah.
I mean, all that stuff went on. I mean, we had the same sheriff, we had the same mayor, we had the same, all that kind of stuff. But it was never, in our town, I never blatantly saw it. I mean, if it went on, and I'm sure it did, it was pretty much sort of undercover, sort of back on the backside. So the same thing, whatever went on with the girls of that was pretty much low key, because even though these towns were small, there were even smaller towns out between the towns. Mm-hmm. And you know what I say? Some weren't really incorporated towns. They were, you know, a grocery store and a gas station and a beer joint, you know, that was 10 miles out in the country or 5 miles out in the country that people went to and did that kind of stuff, which I really didn't see. But, I mean, I know it was there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was out there. So that sort of evolved. What was interesting is that as they evolved and got better, I don't want to say better mixed, I guess they got better educated. Because from our town, they went to Michigan, pick apples and oranges, apples and cherries and that kind of stuff. And then they came back to pick cotton. Well, I'm sure after you've been in the United States for 6 months, some of the guys got pretty smart. I mean, got smarter. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. some of them I'm sure didn't. But they as time went on, things got a little better. Then they started coming in buses. They got rid of the trucks, mm-hmm. and then everybody came in huge buses. Probably were, you know, they were like school buses, but they were pretty good size, and they would come. And I remember the one thing that always happened is they spent all their money, because their money was no good in Mexico because they couldn't buy anything. You think Mexico's impoverished now. Think mm-hmm. about how it was 50 years ago. I mean, you know, 50 years, you're not talking about 10 years ago. You're talking about 50 years ago. So what we did, what my dad did, is we took part of our store and converted it into like a department store.
Hmm.
We sold.
And this was specifically for the Mexican.
You're right.
Okay.
We sold radios.
Hmm.
They wanted you know, transistor radios because there's no electricity. So we sold radios. We sold jewelry. We sold guns. We sold anything that they wanted to buy. And what happened was, because they couldn't, I mean, I had an uncle that was still in Mark Tree, and he was in the clothing business.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a department store. It was the same thing. The money was no good to them. They would buy anything. And I never forget, you'd see them going, they'd pile these buses up with stuff. They'd have sewing machines on there. They'd have, a refrigerator. Anything that they could take back, they would take back.
Refrigerator. Wow.
How about a sewing machine, you know? And they would all, I mean, they'd spend their money on boots. I mean, you know, all kinds of stuff, because it wasn't that they were wasting their money. It was just that they couldn't get into Mexico, and the asset was worth a whole lot more than taking money back.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I remember as things went on, they evolved into being more, a little more sophisticated. I don't know whether what happened was that people learned that if you went to the United States, you could do this, and you know, people got to do it, or they got a more educated, or the same guys. I mean, I'd never know if the same guys ever came back, because they never came back to the same place. Because they would go, you know, Mike came to Mark Tree 1 year, and they went to Lepanto the next year, and they went to Wilson the next year, and wherever. So who knows? Or they could have gone to Mississippi. Who knows where they could have gone? So I don't know is if they came back, they got more sophisticated, they learned a little bit more, and they did a little bit more stuff. But it was a whole, you know, they didn't. I never knew them to mix with anybody. They didn't socialize with.
So nothing. No friends, no girlfriends, white, black, nothing.
Nothing.
Wow.
Nothing that I ever saw. Like I said, I'm sure there were honky tonks and stuff went on, but as far as having any kind of real, you know, going to a church, I mean, they would never have gone to one of the churches in our town. They never would have been. You know, again, the whole system was segregated. I mean, blacks and whites, we didn't go to school. Nobody's going to bring a Mexican home with them to have dinner, you know.
About segregation? I mean, where did Mexicans fit in? Like, if there was a restaurant that didn't serve blacks?
I wouldn't even think of a Mexican going in a restaurant.
Hmm.
I mean, they were... Again, they went in the beer joints, but the blacks, when I say joints, I mean, that's just what they were. I mean, the blacks wouldn't go in the beer place. They had their own. Mm-hmm. But the Mexicans, you know, they were probably got treated one step above, because they were a vital part of the economy. If you didn't have them, they didn't get any of that cotton picked. They didn't get any of that stuff done. So I don't think it was intentionally or unintentionally to treat them bad, treat them worse, whatever. It was just a necessary evil.
What was a necessary evil?
To have them, to bring them. I mean, you know, and if you had them, you did the best you could to get along with them, to get it done. I never remember seeing any fights, anything like that. I mean, look, on Saturday night, if they were drunk, they picked them up, threw them in jail. They took their money they had. Sunday morning, they let them out. They called the farmer, whoever had them, and said, hey, we got four of your guys here. Come get them. Give me $20 a piece or $5 a piece, and they can get out. And he just took it out of their check. Out of their pay. The guy, everybody got paid in cash. There wasn't any checks.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything, different than what's or unusual. I said, I just think it was just at the time of what was going on, there were a way for everybody to make money off of them. And in reverse, they got something that they couldn't get.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like they were working for free. I mean, they were working. And, you know, and I said, and I was figuring they were making about $5 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, minimum wage was just probably 40 cents an hour.
Hmm.
So they were probably making a little, of course, they were working sun up to sun down, and they were to pick or chop or whatever. So they weren't making much less than minimum wage. So it wasn't like they were getting, you know, everybody else was getting $5 and they were getting a dollar.
Right.
I mean, they were getting the money that was in there. And I think the living conditions were pretty rustic.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the only thing. But it was temporary. It's like going to camp. I mean, you know, if you put it in that kind of perspective, they were only staying there for 3 months.
Right.
Nobody was going to build them. You know, they didn't have running water. You had the pump outside, and you went outside and pumped the pump. You had an outhouse for a bathroom. You probably had wire army bunks that were probably left over for a bed and some kind of mattress. Probably had a Coke box for a chair. And that, you know, that was it. But they were working 12 hours a day. And I don't think anybody, they didn't work, they only worked 5 days a week, though. I don't remember anybody working 7 days a week. Most of the stores weren't open on Sundays. And once we noticed that, once my father saw that they would come to town and hang around to go to the movie or whatever they were going to do, and none of the stores were open, we started opening up. And there were no blue laws, actually. But some people had, I don't want to say threatened, they threatened to take legal action against us if we stayed open. But my dad was friends with a judge, and who was a lawyer, because the judges were part-time in the little town. And the judge says, nope, whatever you want to do, you can do whatever you want to do. There's, you're not violating any law. So once we stayed open, everybody stayed open.
Oh, wow.
So the rest of the town opened up. But it was, you know, it was you know, just something that, again, that's just times changed. I mean, the stores only, even in Memphis, the stores weren't open on Sundays.
Wow.
They were only open on Thursday night. And then they start opening on Monday night. And now everybody's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
So it wasn't that we did anything big. It was just evolved and time went on. And so it was, you know, quite interesting. What else do you want me to tell you?
Yeah. Well, let me back up. I have a lot of questions.
Oh, okay.
But
you couldn't interrupt me?
No. I didn't want to interrupt you. Let me back up. Let me back up to the beginning, actually. I know you were a kid, but do you remember, like, hearing that they were going to be coming, or did you have an idea, oh, this thing is about to happen, or is it...
Yeah. They, when, again...
I'm saying the first time you ever saw them, or the first time you remember. I know you were very young. Or maybe you don't remember a time beforehand. I mean, they were coming since 48, so maybe you don't remember a time beforehand. I don't know.
Well, because, I mean, I was always working in the store, even as a 10 or 12-year-old. You know, I guess in the early 50s, I knew they were coming. I mean, because what would happen is, the two people in town were Portis and Stuckey. Each of them were big farmers. So Stuckey's would call us and say, okay, we got a truckload that left Mexico yesterday at 6 o'clock. They're due in here sometime between 10 and 2, and we'll call you when they get here. Well, you know, your mom and dad were at the store getting everything ready because we know they're coming. Okay, so they say, well, okay, we're going home. So, you know, you're just a little kid. If you didn't have a babysitter or whatever, you were in the store. So you'd go home, or if you were with the babysitter, they took the babysitter home. And then they would say, okay, so when the phone rings, we're all going up the store to...
And your whole family would go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd all go. Family operation. And then as I got, you know, a little older, I mean, the time you got to be 13, 14, you know, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, I was... you don't have to be very old to box groceries.
Yeah.
You know, we knew what it was going. You pulled it up. You threw it on the counter. My mother added it up. We put it in a box. All right, next. You know, so
right.
It was one brain surgery.
And do you remember, I mean, particularly when you were older, you would have been not that much younger than these guys. Do you remember interacting with them? Did they think you were a cute kid, or you learned Spanish, or...
You know, you learned to count uno, dos, you know, cuatro, cinco, you know, whatever it was, to count money, whatever. There wasn't any interaction. Today there's no interaction. But all our employees, I know most of them can speak English. They don't speak English. Well, that's our biggest complaint. If I send some guys over to somebody's house to roof a house, the homeowner will call me and say, you know, nobody out here understood any English. I said, ma'am, they understood every bit of English, but they don't speak English because either they're too embarrassed because their English is bad, or they don't want you to know they can speak English. But if you tell them something, they'll do it. So I think it was the same thing. They could understand. I think they could comprehend, but I don't think they wanted to enter because they – I gotta believe, and again, I don't, you know, you've done some stuff in Mexico, or somebody's done some, where they came from. I gotta believe they came from a pretty, you know, uneducated, low class. They weren't very sophisticated. They certainly weren't very you know, had a lot of self-confidence and a lot of that kind of stuff. They were all scared. They didn't know what was going on. I'm sure they had heard all kinds of horror stories. And I'm sure in some towns things happened. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some guys disappeared for talking to the wrong girl or saying the wrong thing to somebody.
Do you think so?
Oh, absolutely.
Huh. Interesting. You're the first person I've heard say that, which is interesting.
It's well, crazy. Look.
But I believe you.
Look, it's common sense. You're talking about farmers are not the nicest guys in the world.
Right.
I mean, Mr. Portis, Mr. Stuckey, Mr. Wilson, they're already at a whole nother, they've already been to universities and college. And, mm-hmm. But there's superintendents that are working out there in the field, that are running the operation, that are driving around out there in those pickups and doing what they got to do at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know they're not the nicest guys. You know they're drinking and they got problems. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's all, and I'm not saying it happened a lot, but you know what happened. There's always some hot-headed Mexican out there, or white guy, or whoever, that's shooting off his mouth or saying something about that girl over there, and he took offense, and I'm sure the guy disappeared. What's the sheriff going to do? I don't know what happened to him. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying that had to have happened.
Right.
I don't, and again, there's no way of knowing because right. You couldn't, you know, you didn't know who was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say it, it's like they all look the same. I mean, every guy had the same pair of jeans, the same plaid shirt. Everybody was, you know, 5'7" tall and weighed 127 pounds. So what are you going to do? And they're not communicating. And, you know, the other thing they did, they went to all the different stores. There wasn't any reason just to shop in my store. They didn't have any allegiance to me. Mm-hmm. So they went to the other store next week. And then mm-hmm. the next week they went to another store.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back. So they didn't build any kind of relationship. And they know they were gone in 3 months.
Right.
What was there to do? I didn't see that happening. And there wasn't any reason for it. There wasn't any reason for it to happen.
For any sort of relationship to develop with anyone. No. Right. Right.
I mean, you know, it would have been nice. It would have been the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But with all the circumstances, there wasn't any reason, you know, you got two different languages, you got all this kind of stuff. There's no reason for that to happen. So I think it's, and it's human nature. I mean, you went to a university, certain people you didn't mix with because you didn't have anything in common. Mm-hmm. You didn't understand their language. And I think that was the same thing. I don't think it was bad or anybody being indifferent. It just wasn't the time to do it, and it wasn't a procedure. There wasn't a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it probably would have been nice if somebody would have said, oh, I remember so-and-so, he came. But I think because of the class, I think it was a class problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a lot of people look at that because we didn't know who they were, what they were. You didn't know where they came from or any of that. See, when you dealt with your black families, you knew where they were and who they were.
Mm-hmm.
They were at a certain level. They either worked in the house, they were either maids or housekeepers or cooks, and you had a certain relation with them, or they were field hands, and a certain relation you didn't have with them because you didn't know them, you didn't see who they were. But I mean, like all my, I mean, you know, everybody had a housekeeper, and you go in, and you know, it was like talking to your aunt or something. You know, they'd make you cookies and milk, and you wanted bread pudding, they'd make bread pudding, and you know, they'd spend the night in your house, and they'd do whatever else you wanted them to do. But that was with that group. With the other people that worked in the fields or worked in the gyms or something, you didn't go to school with them. You didn't see them. You didn't go to the swim. You didn't go to the swim pool with them. You didn't go to the community center with them. You didn't go to church with them. I couldn't even, except for the black people in my town that I actually associated with, which were all adults. I couldn't even tell you a black person's name. And it was just the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, our housekeeper, who was old, when she became our housekeeper, her mother was born, lived during the Civil War. And she worked in the kitchen. So she had taught our maid how to cook and everything. So our maid always worked in the house somewhere. Our housekeeper always worked in the house. She was a cook. So that's why we always ate fried chicken and bread pudding and apple pie every day. But it was, going back to the Mexicans, it's the same thing. You didn't have any reason to associate with it. There wasn't anything there. Hmm. And I don't know nobody I know ever told any story about becoming friends or associating. Now, maybe some of the farmers that were dealing with them every day, they might have got to know somebody and befriended them and everything, but that, I can't even see that happening. I would see that on a very rare occasion, because they thought of it, that was labor. That wasn't right. A buddy. That wasn't a friend. You got 500 pounds of cotton you got to pick today. I don't care how you do it, when you do it, you get it done. Mm-hmm. I don't care anything about you. You just get it done. So.
Huh. And then do you have any other memories about what they would do when they would come to town? You mentioned movies. You mentioned beer joints.
Yeah, I mean, that's all. I mean, I said the whole, you got to remember, this is a little town. It's 100
right.
yards.
Right.
And they would, the whole town would be covered. They'd mostly do their shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's all they did. And I think, when I think back, I'm probably they were doing some socializing, because mm-hmm. it was the only way they could find anybody they knew, was by intermingling on the town. I mean, you know, and a lot of times, and it's pretty sad. I mean, when you think about it, we didn't build them a park at one end of the town with picnic tables and all that kind of stuff. You know, they sat on a curb. You know, that was it. But again, nobody thought about it. It was bad. It was just nobody thought about things like that, to have a park and picnic table and provide them with a social worker to help them write a letter home, or to give them, you know, stuff they need to go in, and open up a new house. You know, we didn't have social services in the 50s. You know, not like now where the government's worried about you. The government didn't worry about you. You either did or you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and all those people had kerosene lamps and very few had electricity, and it was just different time and different place.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I remember going to people's houses. I mean, you know, a lot of people they'd kill their own hogs and their cattle and do all that kind of stuff. They were self-sufficient. So it's a different world. Again, the 50s in the cities were certainly a lot different than the 50s in agricultural-based, you know, in places, which was going on.
And so then when you reflect on your family's store, I mean, do you have a sense of what percentage of the business was Mexican workers during this time, or how this sort of changed your family's economy or the store?
Well, once the Mexicans start coming, we left.
Say that again.
Yeah, because once the Mexicans start, I mean, our whole economy was based on the Mexicans.
Oh, once the Mexicans stopped coming?
Yeah.
You left?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's no more business. Not only did we leave, majority of the people in the towns, as far as the Jewish population, every one of these towns had anywhere from 3 to 5 Jewish families. And we had probably 6 or 7 Jewish families in our town. Had department stores, shoe store, all this kind of stuff. And in all these little towns scattered around, in Marktree and Jonesboro, Paragould, and West Memphis, and you just go all in Wynn, far, you just keep going all these towns, there was pretty good sized Jewish, not good size, but a lot of Jews in these towns. And then when they quit coming, and this whole economy changed over to be more, if the town wound up getting a couple of factories or getting something, they could probably survive. But the basic economy, people didn't stay.
Wow. So then walk me through this. So before the Mexicans came, who was shopping at your store?
Probably, we didn't.
Right, you didn't have your store until
48.
So your whole store, this was what you did.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I guess when my grandfather had the store, the economy was based more on blacks than on Mexicans, because there weren't any Mexicans. But it was a lot smaller economy. I mean, the economy was pretty small. But once the Mexicans started coming, and they built up so much, and it was generating so much, you know, so much income. It was certainly a boom to everybody in the town, because they would never, and that's why they were able to carry him through. And look, some of the guys that were really smart, they invested their money, they educated their children. a lot of those guys that were there in the 50s were GIs, and some of them took advantage while they were in business, took advantage of the GI Bill and went to school. You know, they come to Memphis and go to college, go to Arkansas State and whatever. And so once the things started turning bad, they were able to leave. I mean, we should have probably left in 58 and probably in 60, but you know, my parents had lived there for almost 15 years. They had their house, they had a nice house, had everything. It wasn't just easy living. You didn't have to worry about anything. And you know, you kept saying, well, you know, next year will be better, next year will be better, next year. But you know, you don't have the perspective to say, I mean, you say, well, you know, it's not getting better because they got about less Mexicans and more cotton picking machines. But you still don't want to give up and go. But we finally, they gave up and moved here.
So if you had to put a percent then for the 50s of what percent of your store's business was Mexicans, what would you
probably
say?
80%.
80%.
Yeah.
Wow. And you think that was probably typical among the other store owners?
I think that's pretty typical.
Interesting.
Again, each town was a little different.
Right.
If you were in a bigger town, that might have had
more.
If you were in a town that had closer to the expressway, you know, where they had some road building going on. If you were in a town that had a factory that had come in, I know there's a town called Wynn. They have a big shoe factory. They had some big shoe factories that came in that took care of what their problem was. Some other towns were on railroads. They did a lot of business. It just depended on, you know, what was going on. Before 48, or before World War II, I told you a lot of these towns depended on lumber.
Oh, right.
They're
right.
Big lumber towns.
Right.
And there's pictures, like Lepanto was a riverboat town. And the river was as wide as this room. But they would float the lumber down.
Oh, wow.
And then they have a sawmill in Lepanto. Not that I remember, but I've saw some pictures of it and some stories. And they'd come to Lepanto and they'd float the lumber down. They would cut it up, and then there was a train there, and they'd put the lumber on the train and ship it out. So a lot of people were in the lumber business. And I said, but the population was small, so it wasn't, you know, a lot of people. So a lot of stuff was based on, again, on lumber rather than agriculture. Once they got the fields cleared, it became more agricultural based. And you know, I when the Mexicans were there, it's funny, on the Mexicans, you only saw them on Saturday. Or Saturday and Sunday. Monday, they went, Sunday night, they went back to where they were. You were in school.
Right.
You didn't have any reason to cross paths for anything. You're completely segregated from them. They didn't come to, if they came to town, they would come either early in the morning or late in the afternoon, which odds are you probably didn't see them. They would stop at some little store if they brought them. If it rained, they came to town sometimes, if they could get the boss to bring them. If they couldn't, there wasn't any transportation.
Right.
So that was the only way they could get into town. But if it was good weather and they were working, you didn't see them till Saturday night.
Do you remember anyone with wives or children? You said maybe one or two Texas Mexican families.
But not on the trucks.
Not on the trucks,
not
right.
Not on the trucks, not in the buses.
So you pretty much don't remember there being Mexican kids around.
There was one Mexican in my sixth or seventh grade class.
Really?
He had to be from, I mean, he spoke English, he's from Texas. And I don't remember him after that. I can just remember the situation that he was, you know, was in that class.
So let me ask you, was that still during segregation? Probably,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was in school with you, not with the black kids.
Not with the black kids.
Interesting. Why do you think that was?
I mean, you know, when you get into looking at the segregation side, that was a whole other world. I mean, you know, as bad as the Germans hated us, they hated the blacks worse. They still do. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, if somebody wanted to describe the South like it was. If I go back to Mississippi Burning, that is exactly, nothing in that movie wasn't true, wasn't exactly like it is. Every little town had to say, I could take every little town, somebody in every little town, I could take every one of those people and put a name on them, and that's just the way it was. They didn't have any respect. They didn't have what it was. Again, some towns were worse than others. Some towns, you know, Mississippi was certainly worse, and it depended on what the population was, because some of the towns in Mississippi had more blacks than they had whites, so it made a lot of difference. We didn't have that many blacks. Again, what happened in Arkansas, it's because a lot of stuff evolved from, like I said, from lumber, so we didn't have as many blacks.
Because there wasn't a history there of plantation agriculture.
There wasn't the delta. Right, we didn't have that the big sense. Plantations. Because if you go, like, to Jonesboro, well, there's very few blacks in Jonesboro. And as you get closer to Memphis, the population got bigger and bigger because there were bigger plantations. And as you further you go up towards Jonesboro, and then once you go past Jonesboro, you're in the hills. You're in the Ozarks almost, and there's none. I mean, you go to Paragould and Pocahontas, and you keep going up to Mountain Home, and you keep going up into there, you probably can't find any. Unless some have moved or working for the government, which is very, very few. So, and then as you go into Mississippi, the plantations were bigger and bigger and bigger.
So it seemed logical or normal to you at the time that a Mexican kid would be in school with you and not in school with blacks. For some reason, that made sense. That was never questioned, or you never heard someone say, why is this kid here with us and not in the other school?
You know, till you said it, it never even dawned on me to even think about it.
Interesting.
You know, it just never, you know, well, I know there wouldn't be a black kid there. There's an interesting book in there it's about the 1926 flood.
Oh, yeah. Rising Tide.
Rising Tide. Yeah. Have you read that?
I have looked through it. I haven't read the whole thing.
Well, it's very interesting that the levees still there. Okay, the levees were there. So when all the blacks were... So what they did is the boats ran up and down the Mississippi, and they brought them to Memphis because this is the highest point. They wouldn't bring any blacks. Not because they didn't want to save them, but... What they did, they furnished them places to live and food and everything on the levees. They built them houses because if they got to Memphis, they wouldn't come back to the Delta and they would lose all their labor.
Right.
So they forced them to stay there because if they got here, they knew they were going to St. Louis or Chicago or Detroit, and they lose their labor, so they wouldn't do it. So when you look at that, that's how they thought about them.
Right.
It's a whole different concept.
It is a whole different concept.
Yeah.
So just really quickly, do you remember any problems that came up? Incidents?
Except for, you know, if it was the first of the month, they got to pay their car remote. The sheriff and the county constable would go by, and if they saw, and usually what would happen is, you know, some of them get drunk and they'd walk out the door and pass out, you know, up against the wall or something. They'd drive by and, you know, they'd shake them. If they didn't get up, they'd throw them in jail. You know, they had to make their $20 for the car payment and whatever. I never saw any, you know, I can't remember ever seeing a fight. You know, if there was anything, it would be between two Mexicans. And I don't even remember seeing anything along that line.
Any interactions between blacks and Mexicans?
No.
Nothing.
And you know, it's funny. We don't usually run a black crew and a Mexican crew today.
Mixed. Right.
If we have a crew, we have a black crew, we have a Mexican crew. They won't. Sometimes they may mix if it's one or two, and that's about it. But if there's a black foreman or something, we'll have a Mexicans working for them.
Interesting.
So they have a definite, there is definitely a class structure in that whole, you know, a hierarchy kind of thing. But we never, and again, our town wasn't that black, but I don't ever remember seeing any, you know, incidents.
And then conversely, did people talk about Mexicans either in positive or negative ways? I mean, did you hear them say, oh, you know, these guys are so great or these guys are so awful or anything? Or was it ever a topic about...
You know, occasionally, the only thing I remember is... only thing I remember is positive stuff where somebody would say, oh, you know, I can relate to where somebody was in the store And he was maybe polite. My mother might say, oh, they, you know, those guys were so nice, or, you know, he was this or he was that. But but nothing where, again, you got to go back and remember, there's no social services. There's no social interaction. There's no reason to have any social contact except when they came in the store. And if the Mexican said gracias, then he was... He was a nice guy. What else can he do? What else? You know, there's no anything else you could do about it.
Right.
I think it was just bottom line is it was an economic thing that satisfied the farmers.
Yeah.
Who were smart enough to figure it out. And the Mexicans who were smart enough to get in the line in Mexico, however, I don't know how they got them or how it was or how you applied or how you got on the bus. Whoever they were smart enough to figure out if they got the United States, they could make some money. And the store owners knew that they could sell them stuff because it was going to Mexico. And everybody was happy. And there wasn't any reason to furnish them with anything. There was no reason to have MIFA meals. There wasn't any reason to do any, you know, there was no church that did anything for anybody. You know, we didn't have a Catholic church in our town, but some of the other towns had Catholic church. I don't ever remember anybody saying, well, a Catholic church made meals for them tonight and invited everybody over for a church supper. I mean, you would think that would happen.
Right.
I mean, you know, if we had 50 Israelis show up tomorrow, you know, we're going to do whatever we can do for them. But there was, and maybe it was just the times. I don't, you know. Look, when we had the Hurricane Katrina, I mean, we had a lot of Jews that came here. And we made sure everybody had a place to stay and meals to eat and all that kind of stuff. And some of them stayed. But I don't remember any. I mean, it just wasn't done. I mean, it wasn't even, I think, when there were natural disasters as far as hurricanes, or, I mean, tornadoes or something like that in our little town, there wasn't any. You know, the Red Cross came in and did something or what, but as far as the whole town turning out to do something, I just don't think that was, the 50s just probably wasn't a time. I think everybody was still sort of shell-shocked from World War II, and it was, people just didn't want to be left alone, not be bothered, didn't want to be involved.
So when did your family's store close?
In 63.
I see. And at that time, you remember there were already fewer Mexicans coming. Yeah.
By the 60s, there were fewer.
And that was
because... I think 58 is when they really started putting the cotton picking machine out there. And you'd have to check the day. Probably 55, but by 58, 59, they started, you know, got where they could buy them and they were doing stuff. And it was a lot more economical for them to have them than it was before that.
Anything important that I've forgotten to...
It's pretty dull.
It's not dull.
No, I mean, like I said, it's not...
It's all brain... you lived it.
It's not brain surgery. Like I said, it was an economic situation that everybody benefited from. Now, could they have benefited more? Could they have gotten treated nicer? Could they have gotten a better experience? Could they learn more? Could they have done a whole lot of things? Could they have better living conditions? Sure. But I think it's just the times. I mean, you know, it's just like when you talk to people like us when we were in school in 67 and 68, and the riots and all that kind of stuff, and Kent State and all that. You look at us and you say, what, are y'all crazy or something? We're going to the bar, man. We're not going to be going picking in and riding and doing all that kind of stuff. It was just the times. It wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It wasn't indifferent. It just it just evolved. That just happened to be the time in history that it happened. And I mean, how many demonstrations have there been against the Iraq War? Not many. You know, how many of this and how many of that? It just was a time for Vietnam. It just happened to be a time in history of the world. And the same thing, this was just a time in history that it just happened to be economically feasible for everybody to work out. And, you know, I don't know what the farmer's deal was. I'm sure they made a lot of money, however it worked out. I'm sure the government was subsidizing. They were getting money. They were paying those guys cheaper than whatever they could get. They were getting their crops in quicker. They made a ton of bucks. I'm sure they could have paid them more. You know, I'm sure the storekeepers could have sold the stuff to them cheaper. But it was just what it was.
That's a good question, actually. Did this presence of Mexicans affect the prices of things in your store?
No.
No. Interesting. It hadn't occurred to me.
Fixed prices, supply and demand. There was plenty of supply, so, you know, the demand right. didn't make any difference. So it was, I do think it made some store owners more market conscious.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, just like us, we went into selling, we're a grocery store and we're selling radios and guns and that kind of stuff. You know, my uncle's got a department store selling clothes, men's and women's clothing. He's put in luggage because they had to, once they bought the clothes, they had to get them back to Mexico.
Oh, wow.
I remember he had a whole store full of suitcases and all kind of chests and stuff like that to go back. You'd have the shoe guy that was selling shoes, and he'd put in a whole line of boots because, you know, Western mm-hmm. wear. You'd have a store. I mean, there wasn't any Western wear back in the, I mean, you know, not like, so you'd have a department store that was selling white shirt and black pants, and, you know, they were putting in whole lines of Western wear that would appeal to them. You would see guys that were, look, in our store, we never would carry, our grocery line, we changed to carrying chili peppers.
Tell me, what kinds of stuff did you start carrying?
So we carried flour they could make tortillas out of, and we started carrying, whatever else had a Mexican name, flavor, looked Mexican. You know, you know, when they bring it, the way they used to order is that if you had a grocery store, the wholesaler would bring you a book. It would just be a little pamphlet like this, what they had in stock. And you'd go down the book and you'd say, well, we need two cases of milk and we need three of this for this. So if it had Mexican or anything like that on it, you just order because it would be good, because it would be, you know, what it is. So I think people became more market conscious mm-hmm. and adapted to what they were selling. I mean, mm-hmm. which made them better businessmen and made them more money.
Right.
So it was a change in things that people probably didn't ever do. I mean, I who would have thought some guy selling clothing would be selling luggage?
Right.
You know, I know my uncle. I think they put in lots of jeans. I mean, all they had was a few pair of Levi's. I mean, you know, that wasn't a big thing, but well, these guys came because they were, you know, we perceived them as cowboys, and jeans were what they wore.
What do you mean that you perceived them as cowboys?
Well, I'm just saying they're from Texas. I mean, they were from Mexico.
Right.
I mean, you know, anybody from the West is a, you think of them as being a cowboy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they had the hats and all that kind of stuff. So, I think that's one thing that probably came out of the whole thing. That the guys that had stores became better marketers.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you're saying chili peppers, anything Mexican looking, jeans, yeah. luggage, guns. Huh? They were just buying up a bunch of guns and.
Well, I don't, because see, again, it was they probably couldn't get them in Mexico.
Yeah.
And it was just a something. I mean, they weren't buying them to use, but it was something to trade because again, you go back to Mexico, they're living in agriculture. They're living out in a. You know, they're not living in a city. They're not going to Mexico City. They're going to some little village. Mm-hmm. It probably had snakes and you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So that's probably why they would buy a gun. But big thing was radios.
Huh.
That was probably one of the biggest things that we sold. It's just that my dad was real entrepreneur. He was a pretty good hustler, and he knew. You know, he found out that's what they wanted, and he would come to Memphis and found somebody that would sell them to him, and then he would go put them in. Not that we sold 1,000 radios, but, you know, it was just an added something that we could market to these guys.
And did anyone learn Spanish in the store, pick up a little, hire a bilingual guy? Was that happening, that kind of thing? Some Texas Mexican to be the translator?
Yeah. Maybe in some of the bigger towns.
Yeah.
Savannah. I don't ever remember anybody ever doing that.
Hmm.
I'm sure some, again, you know, some of the other stores, I'm sure somebody may have picked it up or done a little better. And I'm sure my mother, she could understand. I mean, she could converse on the grocery terms and all that with what was going on. Mm-hmm. But again, go back to what I said, there's no socializing. Yeah. You didn't say, you know, how was, you didn't ask me how the weather was, what was going on, how's your family and all that. Nobody cared. It wasn't a problem.
Wow.
All right. That give you an F?
Yeah.
Too much.
Nothing I forgot? No, not too much. Nothing I forgot? Nothing impressions that stand out? Okay.
No, just, well, like I said, it was pretty dull.
Well, thank you, Bernard. I appreciate it.
Bye.